Welcome to this very interesting interview. Well, it's very interesting for me, anyway, as the present manager of 2RPH. I'm very privileged to welcome into the studio today Emeritus Professor Ron Possel, who was, I think, Ron, you were the first chairman of 2RPH, is that correct?
No, I was the second chairman, but I was a chairman who really got the station onto the air. Our foundation chairman was actually Professor Neil Runcie, who drew up the constitution of the RPH cooperative and lobbied for the initial government grant from which we bought our first transmitter.
Is that a previous one to the one at Prospect?
I think we're still using it, but initially the transmitter was located at Homebush Bay where the Olympic site is now. And I think it's still the transmitter. Initially we used the mast to transmit from the Homebush site, the mast of the University of New South Wales. But when the Bicentennial Park was built, all that equipment was moved.
Also in the studio, we're very glad to welcome Mr. Jeff Brown, who is my predecessor by four, the very first 2RPH manager. Good to have you here. Jeff, you presently own and run Bay FM on the Central Coast?
Yes, on at Port Stephens, actually. But the original 2RPH studios were nothing like I'm looking around this palace you're in now.
Make some comparisons. That would be wonderful for the listener.
I'll tell you about day one of 2RPH, 18th of April. Actually, I'll go back a couple of weeks before the 18th of April, 1983. We were very lucky. We had a lot of assistance. We started, as Ron has alluded to, with virtually no money, with great help from Radio 2SM and technician, I'm trying to think of his name. I think it was Max Wilson. Max Wilson. So my memory's not so bad after 30 years. He managed to get for us a spare studio in the 2SM studio complex up on the seventh floor of 186 Blues Point Road with a magnificent view of the harbour, probably the best view of any radio station anywhere in the world. And here we are, 2 weeks out from trying to get on the air, and I've got probably 40 to 50 potential volunteers lined up in the 2SM lobby, the 2SM jocks wandering around, playing all the music that 2SM played in the 1980s.
I think it was power of the 80s, yeah, 2SM at the time.
Okay. And they were all wandering around, wondering who all these strange people were invading the rock station of Sydney. We went through an audition process because we were starting right from scratch, and as I said, we had about 40 or 50 volunteers, which in an audition process in one day we managed to cut down to 10 to 12 that we believed were suitable. Then we had to come up with a way of presenting newspapers that had never been done before. There was a few test transmissions done from the old Paddington Town Hall through Radio Eastern Sydney to convince the government that it is possible. But those test broadcasts had one voice reading a newspaper beginning to end for about an hour and a half. One voice, no pre-reading, of course, and of course reader fatigue settling in about halfway through. And
reader fatigue
mistakes.
And probably listener fatigue, I should
absolutely
think.
So I came up with the idea of the format that we would have two readers and an announcer. So the announcer could look after all the technical side of things and look after all the music stings that we had planned and the other things. Well, the readers could just concentrate on the reading and alternate story for story, preferably male and female, so we had that light and shade.
And we still basically use the same format.
Because it keeps the interest of the listener going. In those days, we didn't refer the page numbers. It was only as we went along we realised that a lot of teachers of English as a second language were actually using Radio 2RPH as a teaching tool. So then, and following along. And to make it easier for them, then we started using the page numbers and dividing up the newspapers so that we didn't just go through the, in those days, the Daily Mirror and the Sun in the afternoons, for example, straight through. We separated sport out. We separated the letters of the editors into one package. We separated the editorials into one package and the features into a features package so that it became like a magazine program rather than just a straight reading of the newspapers. Of course, the news vital and important, but the other parts of the newspaper are also important. I still punch into 100.5 at Newcastle sometime around 8:15 in the morning to hear the Stars. So it's still all there. So those early days were really funny, and up in that top floor, there was no facilities for prepping anything, so I
should point out that before we actually went on air, the most difficult job I had was to, not so much to get volunteers, but to keep them happy, because there was no broadcasting occurring. And I really think the best thing we did at that time, and I really mean this, was to hire Jeff as our station manager, because as you mentioned, Nikki, the programming today is still really basically the same structure as Jeff had on that very first day. And our main job was to convince the federal government that the RPH stations deserved a license. And
a full license.
A proper broadcasting license. I think few people will realise that initially, and I think all the time that Jeff was our station manager, we were not legally a radio station. We were not broadcasting under the Broadcasting Act, rather under the Wireless and Telegraphy Act. And that pushed us right to the end of the band, I think 1629 kilohertz at the time. And this had some interesting side effects. We weren't regulated as a broadcasting station. So, for example, I don't know, Jeff, if you remember, but at that time, radio stations were not allowed to broadcast election material 3 days prior to an election. Yes, but we were not a radio station in the legal sense of the word. So we did broadcast. We read from the newspaper right up to and including the election day.
Saturday morning papers.
That's
full
right.
Of election stuff on the election day.
Yeah, and I think it was maybe the 1983 election that created a lot of attention. I think it was that one. But our main job as a board was to convince the government to give us a proper license. And that took a few years.
When did that actually happen?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think it was Tony Staley. Maybe he was the last Minister for Communications in the Fraser government, if my memory serves me rightly. And I think it was him. He was the one who gave the dedicated RPH licenses. And maybe our current listeners won't realise, and unfortunately, I have to say that there was a lot of opposition to that at the time. People that we thought would be supportive and groups were not supportive.
There's a lot of fractional infighting, as they say in politics.
That's right. Mm. From
other community stations?
Yes, from other community stations, from institutions serving disabled people. It was felt here and there that we were treading on their territory and so forth. So it took us quite a long time to convince a whole series of communication ministers that RPH stations deserved a licence. And eventually, the way we really achieved that is all the RPH stations around Australia really got together and lobbied the federal government to such an extent that they had to grant.
As each one came online, of course, RPH became stronger. There was a short-lived hope, Ron, if you recall, that we're hopeful that we might be taken under the wing of the Special Broadcasting Service.
That's right.
Because as we read the Act, it was special broadcasting that we were doing. And really, it should be a government obligation. They didn't see it that way.
So for the listener who's just joined us on 2RPH, you're listening to an interview with Emeritus Professor Ron Possel, who was the second chair of 2RPH, and 2RPH's very first manager, Jeff Brown. Thank you for joining us. I wanted to see whether you could remember any incidents, perhaps some anecdotes, some war stories from the early days. I think, Jeff, you did mention to me before we came on air something about a previous manager, Mr. Tom Crozier.
Tom was a friend of mine from commercial radio. Tom was involved in 2UE and, of course, the Radio Marketing Bureau, part of the Commercial Radio Australia, as they're called now. And when Ron retired, I had just come back to RPH in a volunteer capacity to train volunteers at the Marrickville studios. So Tom came in, offered his services as a volunteer, and I said, well, like everyone else, Tom, you'll have to go through the training. So I think it was a particular Wednesday night. Tom and a few others were in there, and I took them through their training. And Tom nearly missed the last train home to the Shire. He has, unto his untimely passing, reminded me of that every time I've caught up with Ron. You nearly made me lose my train.
You never forgot it.
No. Well, we had a policy. Well, I had a policy that you know, we keep doing it until we get it right. Yeah. Sorry, Tom.
Maybe 6 months or so after we went to air, we're still expanding the number of hours. I think Jeff mentioned we started off with 2 hours per day, but by that time we were on air most of the day. And one day, I think I remember Frieda, my wife, I couldn't see buses at that time. My wife pointed out, look, there's a bus, and on the side it says, now there's a radio station for people who can't see this bus. 2RPH, turning reading into listening. And then we saw more buses and more buses, and almost every second bus in Sydney on the side or the back had this sign, which created an enormous interest from people who could see the bus. And I think Jeff might have an explanation for this.
Well, we have to be thankful there's so many different organisations and companies that helped us out in the early days. You spoke about Jono and Denno, their support in those early days. And without the help of 2SM, particularly 2SM, the University of New South Wales with the hut and the transmitter site at Homebush Bay, and George Patterson Advertising, one of the large advertising agencies at the time, where I spent a short while as a trainee copywriter, we decided we needed to get the word out. How are we going to do this? So I went and knocked on the door and said, this is what we're about. Would you take us on as a community service charity?
Pro bono.
And they threw it around for a while and said, yeah, that could be a challenge. And they took us on. They came up with these series of signs, front of buses, distress space in the newspapers, you know, where they can't sell the last remaining spot. So in goes a charity ad. That was us. Yeah. Billboards. We had a couple of large 24-sheet billboards that they did for us, all free of charge, all the material, all the space, all the creative, all free. Now there's a radio station for people who can't read this sign sitting on the desk outside in the reception area of the Glebe studio. So I think that's marvellous that it's still around, turning reading into listening. We started off with the slogan on the first day. I was running a recording studio and I had some royalty-free music, and we started off with a jingle. I think we're probably the only RPA station that had our own jingle there for a while. We've got the whole world waiting for you was the sung line which we used to promote ourselves. And as Ron said, those first days, we used to do the now defunct Daily Mirror and the now defunct Daily Sun from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. in the afternoons. And that's how it started. Within weeks, we had expanded to the morning papers as we gathered more volunteers. Without that help of those organisations of that time, it would never have got off the ground.
And I don't know how many listeners would think that 2RPH owes a lot to the union movement. But in fact, the Builders Workers Industrial Union was quite a big benefactor of ours, and there's quite a nice story behind this. I think it was after Jeff left, we couldn't afford to pay Jeff anymore. Of course, Jeff's a professional radio man. He has to eat.
I did stay on as a volunteer on the member of the board for another 12 months before I moved away.
Yeah, and anyway, eventually we really did run out of money. And, of course, we're not supposed to continue to trade while we're insolvent and we're on the verge of insolvency. And I was always against, Jeff will remember this, against the station going to air, appealing to our listeners for donations. I didn't think this was right. Well, when one of the blind members of our board starts talking about rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic and so on, I thought, well, maybe it's time to have an appeal to our listeners. This is it. We either raise some money or we go off air. I think within 24 hours of an appeal, we received a phone call from a gentleman by the name of Pat Clancy. Older listeners will probably recognise that name as being certainly one of the leaders of the Australian Communist Party in the 1950s, who in fact thwarted the then Prime Minister, Mr. Menzies, from passing a constitutional amendment to outlaw the Communist Party in Australia. So Pat Clancy was very well known. He was a leader of the Building Workers Union. What we didn't know is that he was a bricklayer, actually, by trade. He'd become blind in his later years and was quite a keen listener to 2RPH. You don't really know who's listening. We had on Saturday morning, just before the reading of the newspapers, I think, at that time, a regular series of short Russian stories from the Russian literature. And Pat used to like to listen to these. So it's all very interesting. He heard this appeal within, as I say, 24 hours of us going to air. And he just could not believe that here was a station run by volunteers producing this kind of service. And so he took us along to State Parliament House and banged a few heads together over there, and that was the beginning of our government grant, which saved us, financially speaking.
I was still involved at that time, and that was still in the North Sydney days before we moved out to Marrickville.
And the Building Workers Union built us a studio, I think, through Lend Lease.
Because 2SM, in their goodness of heart, or in the need to get us out of the lobby upstairs,
I think that was more to the point.
Found a space on the first floor there at 186 Bliss Point Road.
That's right.
And no studio, of course, but 2SM said, well, we're finished with our knockdown studio that we use at Luna Park. They had a studio where they should do 8 hits in a row on Saturday nights from Luna Park. They said, you can have that. So it arrived one day on the back of the truck. The first floor studio's there, actually with the street beside, meant that the loading dock came in right at the same level. And, well, knockdown studio is probably, you know, 12 foot by 12 foot by 12 foot by 12 foot, all in panels. So here we are, group of volunteers, trying to lug this thing in to the space we had. Well, Max Wilson again, put his boys to work on it and set it up. He had an old RME panel that Lentis gave us. So we ended up with quite a good studio. And then eventually, through the goodness of Pat Clancy and his friends, we had a new studio built in that space as well.
I should also mention that Max Wilson, whose name Jeff's mentioned a few times, the technician that helped us, I think from memory at the time, he was technician for 2WS, and they were a music station, then now on the FM band. But at that time, they're an AM station on 1224 kilohertz, which listeners might recognise as the station they're listening to now.
And so there was great help at that time too. And you mentioned earlier the first transmitter. Well, that was only 500 watts too, and on the short mast at Homebush Bay, and just off frequency, if you like, at 1629, you know, the signal kind of just trickled off into the swamp somewhere. It wasn't a great coverage. Then we got 1,000 watts, and I think that's when we had moved to Marrickville, and then, of course, the 5,000 watts with the 1224X2WS transmitters out there at Prospect. Great. And the 100.5 at King's Cross, is it? Yeah, the one at Newcastle.
Coming towards the end of our time, unfortunately, but I'm very interested, particularly, Ron, perhaps, how did you go about getting your first volunteers? Because at the moment, 2RPH is in a very fortunate position of actually not having to ask. People come to us, and we're very, very lucky and grateful about that.
Well, actually, we've never had much trouble raising volunteers, even before we went to air. As I mentioned before, that was a problem. We could raise the volunteers, but we had hardly anything for them to do. And I've got to mention the name here, and Jeff will remember these people, Dr. Sam McGillis and his wife Elizabeth McGillis. Sam was the medical superintendent of the Sydney Eye Hospital when it was the old hospital on Sir John Young Crescent. And Elizabeth was our volunteer coordinator. And I think the very fact that this was a radio station, you had the prospect of reading on air rather than just announcing, and the type of radio station that we were did attract volunteers. And Pat Clancy, who helped us so much, always had trouble coming to grips with the fact that we were completely dependent on volunteers. That to him was an enormous positive. So that's been a very, very fortunate part of our activities.
Those volunteers were not only very enthusiastic, they were all good readers. We had quite a few who worked in theatricals. We had some aspiring, you know, ensemble students, radio people. I don't know whether you remember a guy called Peter DeLille, who was there for a while. Strange name, but Peter was another one of those deep, rich voices. Finding the best suit and times were always the problem. And Elizabeth Gilley, as Ron said, she looked after that coordination of filling the shifts and making sure that...
This was before Jan Marchant came on the scene?
Yeah. Jan was a very early starter. And Jan and Norman Banks and... Was it Elizabeth? I can't remember. They took over as a management committee.
Sylvia Glover.
Took over as a management committee after I moved on. Getting volunteers has never been a real problem. Finding the right one for the right choice. Like, how long did Jan do the Women's Weekly for? I mean, you couldn't have found anyone else at that time who would do the Women's Weekly the way that Jan did. So you found special people, and there's always people willing to help. We're talking about some of the early publicity we got through George Patterson, and there was a community service announcement I wrote, and I thought, now, who can I, you know, sidle up to and just say, excuse me, can you record this for me? And of course, Ron Hadrick, who well-known actor around Sydney, said, I'll do it.
And that was the little promo. Was that the promo you sent to me?
Yes, it was. So that was recorded in those early months. And they were always there. Volunteers were always there. And then the sad part was having to say to someone, no, look, you're not quite suitable to read on air, but wow, we would love you to do some prep. We would love you to do this. You're not a great reader, but you've got a lovely voice. Would you like to be on the announcing side? So finding the right fit for the right person was more challenging than actually finding volunteers, because they came from everywhere.
And another difficult thing that I found was, I mean, we are radio for the print handicapped. We're not radio by the print handicapped. I mean, I'm totally blind, so I'm not going to be a very good reader. And even though I'm a professor of physics, I'm not very good at putting studio equipment together. I know how it works and the theory of it. Now, we did have some help, especially in the early days, from blind and visually impaired and other print handicapped people, and that was very, very welcome. But some wanted to be announcers, and as Jeff says, not everybody is suitable. I mean, I want to listen to as professional a service as we can possibly present, and I'm sure that's true of all our other listeners. And that was difficult to say to people who are really very enthusiastic, no, you know, we'd like to use your services, but you just don't have the qualities to be an announcer or a reader, or whatever.
The difference is that even though 2RPH is considered as a community station, unlike the other community stations, 2RPH serves a particular interest of a particular part of the community, whereas the other community stations is actually giving a voice to people from the community. So it kind of works around the reverse way, in that we're providing a service, whereas the community radio stations in general are inviting people of the community to actually add their voice to the airwaves. So a little bit different. But as Ron said, so many people, and you may remember another dear friend of mine, Matt Ponsonby.
Yes, I was about to mention
I have worked
that,
with many blind announcers. Matt also passed, worked with Matt at 2MG in Mudgee. He came in to offer his professional assistance. He's a professional broadcaster, but totally blind. So it depends upon circumstances, and as it says, finding the fit for the person was the thing.
Yes. So, Jeff, just to finish off, I was just wondering whether you could reminisce a little bit about the actual day of the first broadcast, the 18th of April, 1983. Can you remember details of
what happened? Yes, I vaguely remember now. It's 30 years ago now, Nikki, but there's some bits.
Just yesterday.
As I said, it was from the spare studio in the 2SM complex upstairs with the beautiful view. We had been practicing the volunteers for a couple of weeks beforehand. I think we only had about a fortnight to go through things with the volunteers, so we're practicing. In the meantime, we're running test transmission of Royal Blind Society tapes just to keep the signal going and say that it was there. And then it was 4 p.m. on the 18th of April, 1983. We started off with the Daily Mirror.
Were you nervous?
Yeah, I'd been at 2SM since about 10 that morning. So, yes, yes. And more nervous for the volunteers than for myself. Mm. I knew the systems worked. I had faith in them, but they were nervous. So keeping them enthused and on the game was the important thing that day. I borrowed a card table from home. I said to my wife, we just have no preparation space in the studio, so I borrowed a card table. And I thought the best way of doing the newspapers was, of course, single-edged razor blades, and you just cut out the stories, put them into a manila folder, there's yours and there's the other readers, and away we go. But of course, after three cuts of the newspaper, the card table was cut to shreds. My wife has never forgiven me for that. But we got it on the air. We did the Daily Mirror in a similar format that you do the Telegraph and the Herald nowadays, and we did the news, and then together we did the Sun, the editorials, and the letters to the editors. Always important letters to the editors, because of the community talking back. Well, the important thing is that if you need the services of 2RPH, you can hear the news on any radio station, you can listen to the audio of television, but what the people are saying comes in the letters to the editors. What the newspapers are saying in their opinion pieces, you don't get anywhere else. So it was always important from day one.
That makes it a unique service, and that's
absolutely
our special
thing.
And
it's continued to be for the 30 years since that first day, the 18th of April. We did 2 hours. We came off. Oh, I'll say it. I went downstairs to the hotel on the ground floor and had the biggest scotch you've ever seen. It was done.
There were one or two volunteers, perhaps, and board members with you. At that time, that was day one. Well deserved.
And it went on from there. And from the 2 hours, it grew to more. We just started doing mornings. And then, as I said, we moved downstairs, new studios, off the Marrickville. And now here you are running this absolutely essential and wonderful service from these palatial studios at Glebe. I think that's terrific. And congratulations. And if I can say congratulations to 2RPH, I mean congratulations to every single volunteer who has contributed over those 30 years. That's what makes 2RPH work.
That's right. And I distinctly remember words that Jeff used, if not that day, very just before that day. I mean, Jeff, you were not the only one that was nervous that day. And Jeff said, and I remember your words exactly, we're going to creep onto the air. I remember the word, creep onto the air, not with a big bang. And really, it was a very clever move, because Jeff was able to set the pattern of programming right from those first 2 hours, and then the 2 hours became 4 hours, and then 6 hours, and so on. And I don't know how many listeners we had in the first few days.
Every volunteer's friend.
That's right, every volunteer and their friend. But we certainly built up gradually from that point, and it was very successful to go to air in that way. And, as Jeff says, it's unique.
And there are very many untold numbers of people that we should be thanking, just like the Oscars. It could go on forever, but I'm sure both Ron and Jeff will join me in a huge thank you for all those volunteers, both those that are still with us, those that are with us as newer volunteers, and certainly those that started the ball rolling back in 1983. Thank you so much, Emeritus Professor Ron Possel, for your contribution today. Thank you for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jeff Brown.
Thanks, Nikki.